Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Something mysterious plagues County Mayo on the west coast of Ireland and its legendary Gaelic football team.
Sometimes I think there's something sinister going on.
I believe in the curse. I think it's real.
Listen to the curious tale of the Mayo Curse on Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service. Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Friday, the 8th of December, these are our main stories. With ever-intensifying violence in Gaza, the head of humanitarian affairs for the United Nations said there's no longer any humanitarian operation worthy of that name in the south of the territory. Tens of thousands of Palestinians are streaming into Rafah City near the Gaza Strip's southern border with Egypt, trying to escape intense fighting elsewhere. In other news, the United States has reiterated its support for Guyana's sovereignty as tensions rise over plans announced by Venezuela to annex the oil-rich region of Essequibo. Also in this podcast, Italian opera, big, bold, and now recognised by the UN, no less. We begin in Gaza. After 2 months of war, four-fifths of Gaza's residents, according to the UN, have been displaced, many of them several times over. Their homes, businesses, mosques and schools have been damaged, destroyed or abandoned as too dangerous. And many of them are now constantly on the move from northern Gaza, where Israel began its military campaign against Hamas, deemed a terror organisation by many Western governments, to Khan Yunis. That's now the focus of Israeli ground and air operations. Tens of thousands of Palestinians are now fleeing further south to Rafah City on the border with Egypt. The streets of Rafah are now packed with people with shortages in water and electricity. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams, in Jerusalem.
This Gaza war, unprecedented in scope, has now been raging for 2 months. The Hamas-run health ministry says more than 17,000 people have been killed, including thousands of children. Israel's military operation in the southern Gaza Strip, currently focused on the largest city there, Khan Yunis, is making a difficult humanitarian situation worse. The UN says 80% of the population has been displaced. People are running out of safe havens and not enough aid is getting in. Speaking in Geneva, the UN's top aid official, Martin Griffiths, gave this bleak assessment.
The message that we have been giving, we here being the humanitarian community, is that we do not have a humanitarian operation in southern Gaza that can be called by that name anymore. That the pace of the military assault in southern Gaza is a repeat of the assault in northern Gaza.
Martin Griffiths said negotiations were underway with Israel to open another crossing into Gaza to allow more aid in. Israeli officials say they're willing to do what they can to keep aid flowing and to facilitate the opening of additional field hospitals to help cope with the huge numbers of casualties. With fighting raging around Khan Yunis and in the north, images are circulating on social media showing dozens of Palestinian men stripped to their underwear, kneeling on the ground, being guarded by Israeli soldiers. Other pictures show them being transported in military trucks. Israel's chief military spokesman, Daniel Hagari, said hundreds of what he called terror suspects had been detained and that many had given themselves up. But already one well-known Palestinian journalist has been identified as among those being held.
For more on the aid situation in Gaza, Matthew Anroliwala spoke to Shina Lowe from the Norwegian Refugee Council.
What our workers are sharing with us, our 54 staff on the ground in Gaza, is simply devastating. They are at the point now where we have had to cease our operation, effectively cease our operations in Gaza, because our staff cannot deliver aid when they are themselves in need of aid and struggling to find the basic necessities. Food, clean water, a safe place to sleep, even a place to sleep. We have multiple staff members who are sleeping on the streets, including a staff member with her two-month-old baby. This is how desperate and dire the situation is, with ongoing hostilities, mass displacement, 60% of housing damaged or destroyed. It is simply impossible to deliver a meaningful humanitarian response under such conditions.
Since the ceasefire broke down last Friday, how much worse has the situation got on the ground?
What we are hearing from the staff is that the situation has just continued to deteriorate since the end of the pause. In some ways, they feel like they were lulled into a false sense of security. And what has happened since the collapse of the pause has just been more ruthless, more devastating than what they saw during the 7 weeks that preceded it. They are describing continuous bombardments, mass panic and chaos as supplies rapidly dwindle. They've just told us about stores that have simply shut because they have nothing left to sell. People are desperate. People are being pushed from Khan Yunis west towards the Mediterranean Sea and south towards Rafah, seeking any type of safe place. But there simply is no safe place in Gaza. The only way to guarantee the security of the 2.3 million people trapped inside of Gaza is to have an immediate, permanent, sustained ceasefire.
Well, Israel says it's not targeting civilians, but says Hamas hides its weapons and command centres among a civilian population that it uses as so-called human shields. The Israeli government spokesperson, Ilan Levy, on Thursday accused Hamas of deliberately launching attacks from areas in Khan Yunis which Israel has designated safe zones.
Hamas is doubling down on its human shield strategy in flagrant violation of international law and every norm of human decency. Israel designated the Al-Mawasi area as a humanitarian zone because Hamas has not embedded itself there under homes and schools and hospitals, and that is why Hamas is cynically abusing the humanitarian zone in order to continue attacking the people of Israel and then try to hide behind their own people and evade justice.
The Israeli government spokesman, Ilan Levy. The British Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, who's on a visit to Washington, has said that Presidents Putin and Xi will be the only people smiling if America fails to send more aid to Ukraine. Republicans in the Senate on Wednesday night refused to back a bill containing nearly $115 billion worth of aid for Kyiv. Speaking at a press conference alongside the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, Lord Cameron said this was a defining moment.
I wanted to be in Washington, D.C. this week to make the point about how important it is that we go on funding Ukraine and helping Ukraine in every way we can. I see it as the challenge of our generation, just as my grandfather's generation had to fight off Nazi aggression in Europe. We are fighting against Russian aggression in Europe.
Mr. Blinken said the United States and UK both share the same values with regards to Ukraine.
Our countries are in lockstep when it comes to continuing to do everything possible to ensure that Putin's aggression remains a strategic defeat and failure for Russia, and determined to ensure that Ukraine continues to stand strongly on its own feet as a sovereign independent countries.
Britain has summoned the Russian ambassador over what it called sustained but unsuccessful attempts to interfere in British politics through a cyber hacking campaign. The UK has accused Russia's security service, the FSB, of conducting a cyber hacking campaign over a number of years to disrupt the democratic process. The British government says the FSB targeted hundreds of people, including politicians, civil servants and journalists, from at least 2015. Russia has always denied such activity. Our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera, reports.
A sustained attempt to interfere in UK politics. That is how this campaign is being described by British officials. Behind it is alleged to be Centre 18, a unit of Russia's FSB security service. It would impersonate personal contacts to try to hack into the private email accounts of people in public life. The Foreign Office Minister, Leo Doherty, told the Commons that it and the House of Lords had been in the group's sights.
They have targeted members of this House and the other place. They have been targeting civil servants, journalists and NGOs. They have been targeting high-profile individuals and entities with a clear intent, using information they obtain to meddle in British politics.
Earlier this year, the SNP MP Stuart MacDonald told the BBC he believed his emails had been stolen. In another case, documents about US-UK trade talks were taken from Liam Fox, who'd been Trade Secretary. These were then made public during the 2019 election. But ministers said they believed that overall the hackers had been unsuccessful at interfering in political life. The Russian ambassador was summoned yesterday to the Foreign Office, although he was said to be unavailable, and officials talked to his deputy. The UK has also sanctioned two individuals, one of them a serving FSB officer. The US Department of Justice sanctioned and indicted the same pair, accusing them of also targeting American officials. Russia has always dismissed accusations that it's involved in hacking or political interference.
Gordon Carrera. The Oscar-winning British director Steve McQueen's formidable track record includes acclaimed features on the 1981 IRA hunger strike, on sex addiction and on slavery. Now he's turned to the Nazi occupation of Amsterdam during the Second World War, during which three-quarters of the Dutch Jewish population were killed. McQueen has been promoting his documentary, which opens first in the US this month, at a time when reports about anti-Semitism have increased because of the conflict in the Middle East. But as he's been telling the BBC's Tom Brooke, this has merely made his film more vital and urgent.
In May 1940, Amsterdam was taken over by the Germans.
Actress Melanie Hyams narrates the Steve McQueen documentary, which is a family endeavour. The director lives in Amsterdam, and it's a project inspired by his Dutch wife, Bianca Stigter, an historian and filmmaker who wrote a book, Atlas of an Occupied City, a door-to-door compendium detailing the fate of Amsterdam Jews and others during the Nazi occupation.
Soon, the Nazis started to ban Jews from parks, pools, shops, cafes and schools, from all public life. Music by Jewish composers could no longer be played.
Steve McQueen's film juxtaposes images of COVID-era Amsterdam with chilling stories of the Nazis' systematic efforts to extinguish Jewish life from its neighbourhoods. The director hopes his film brings out from the shadows a very dark chapter in the history of his adopted city.
What really shocked me in some ways when I first started living in Amsterdam is that I felt that I was living with ghosts, that there was another narrative going on other than my own. And somehow to trace that through the present day was sort of, for me, vital. I needed it was the evidence of things not seen. With my film, what I'm trying to say, that it doesn't make sense. I mean, how do you make sense out of 6 million people being executed?
Out we came of these wagons. We had to line up. And I asked, where are we? And he told me Auschwitz.
Other documentaries on the Holocaust, like the landmark 1985 French film Shoah, use testimony from Holocaust survivors themselves, but that population is fast disappearing. So, as Steve McQueen's wife, Bianca, explains, Occupied City tries to tell the story in a different way.
There's no talking heads, there's no archive footage. What you see is contemporary images of Amsterdam on the street. You are seeing what happened there during the German occupation of Amsterdam.
In a tumultuous time with the ongoing war in Ukraine and the conflict in the Middle East, Steve McQueen hopes his film makes audiences aware of pending political dangers.
It's a cause to arms in some ways for sort of being active in our everyday to make it, you know, just change things, you know. We have to be proactive, particularly in these times, you know. It's all about love. It's anything worth dying for and worth living for.
The film is arriving in cinemas at a time when the Middle East conflict has become very inflamed once again, and anti-Semitism, by different accounts, is rising. Do you think that's going to change the way in which people view the film?
Yes. In fact, that maybe it made the film more vital, more urgent. This is a film about resilience and triumph. And that's all, you know, Jews, non-Jews, whatever. It has a sense of human beings who are resilient and, you know, come through it all.
Steve McQueen's film opens in the US on Christmas Day. It arrives in UK cinemas later in the new year. It's hardly festive fare, but it's been lauded as a monumental film, although there have been detractors. The 4-hour and 22 minutes running time does intimidate. But to its admirers, it's an original and artful excavation of the terrifying darkness that gripped Amsterdam more than 80 years ago.
In 1941, they started rounding people up. In 1942, the deportations began.
That report was by Tom Brooke. Still to come.
LEGO needs no introduction, but for those unfamiliar with Fortnite, it's one of the biggest online games in the world, attracting more than 70 million players a month.
And now, participants of one of the world's biggest video games will now be able to build their own virtual objects with LEGO bricks.
The Global News Podcast brings you the world's latest breaking news and developments. But some stories need a little more time. I'm Katia Adler, host of the brand new BBC World Service podcast, The Global Story. Every weekday, The Global Story peels back the layers on one major news story with insights from the BBC's worldwide network of experts. So find out all the latest news right here on The Global News Podcast and then dive into one big story with me on The Global Story. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back. The United States has said it stands by its unwavering support for Guyana's sovereignty. That's after Venezuela announced plans to annex the oil-rich Essequibo region. Well, earlier, the US said it would carry out joint Air Force manoeuvres with Guyana. At a news conference, the spokesman for the White House National Security Council, John Kirby, said the US wanted to see a peaceful resolution to the dispute between the two countries.
We obviously support the peaceful resolution of the border dispute between Venezuela and Guyana, and we absolutely stand by our unwavering support for Guyana's sovereignty. The 1899 arbitral award that determined the land boundary between those two countries should be respected unless or until the parties themselves reach a new agreement or a competent legal body decides otherwise, and that hadn't happened. So we're going to urge Venezuela and Guyana to continue to seek a peaceful resolution of this dispute, including by the International Court of Justice.
A referendum in Venezuela supported the country's long-standing claim to Essequibo. Caracas has even given concessions to some of its oil companies there. Well, now Brazil says it's sending more soldiers to its northern border with Venezuela. I heard more about the dispute between Guyana and Venezuela from the BBC's South America correspondent, Katie Watson. Firstly, about the comments from the US embassy in the Guyanese capital, Georgetown.
So the embassy in the capital, Georgetown, has said that it's remaining a trusted security partner and it's continuing to work with Guyana's armed forces over many areas. So this is a clear sign of the concerns in the region as a result of the referendum on Sunday.
And Brazil's worried as well because it shares a border both with Venezuela and Guyana, doesn't it?
Yeah, so, I mean, here in Brazil, the president, Lula da Silva, has been an ally in the past with Maduro, but there is growing concern about the kind of belligerent approach that the government in Venezuela is taking. They've said that they've bolstered the number of troops on the border in Roraima State with Venezuela. They're also bringing in more armoured vehicles as a result, and they've talked to the Maduro administration, voicing their concerns over the increasing tension there.
I mean, do you think there's any real danger that there might be some kind of military confrontation between Venezuela and Guyana over this?
It's hard because, I mean, I think when people saw what was happening with the referendum in Venezuela, some people were, you know, thinking, really, is this just a posturing before trying to get popularity ahead of a 2024 election or indeed trying to put off the election because, giving the excuse of war or something like that. They were trying to understand what was behind the moves. But, I mean, the fact that they're bolstering troops. I mean, there's a lot to lose for Venezuela, especially the fact that they've just had their sanctions, the US sanctions, some lifted on the oil industry. And those, it's a threat to kind of whip them back on again if there is aggression. But yeah, it's a real concern what exactly where Venezuela really wants to go with this.
Katie Watson. The British Home Secretary, James Cleverly, has criticised a move by the tech giant Meta to roll out end-to-end encryption for all personal chats and calls on Facebook and Messenger. It means Meta will no longer have access to the contents of what users send or receive unless someone involved in the chat reports a message to the company. Our technology editor Zoe Kleinman reports.
Meta has been promising to encrypt Messenger for a while now. It's already available for those who choose to opt in, but will now be the default option. Supporters of encryption argue that it protects everybody's privacy and security and is for some, such as activists operating under harsh regimes, a crucial tool for survival. End-to-end encryption cannot be broken by either the firm which operates it or by law enforcement. The child protection charity the Internet Watch Foundation described Meta's move as catastrophic, saying it will make it more difficult to catch those using Messenger to groom and harm children. Meta said it had a variety of other tools which would enable it to proactively detect accounts engaged in malicious behaviour without scanning messages.
Zoe Kleinman. The makers of one of the world's biggest video games, Fortnite, have released a high-profile collaboration with the Danish construction toy company Lego. Epic Games, whose revenues topped $5.6 billion last year, say they want to reach new audiences, from children to adults. Once the games go live, players will be able to build their own virtual objects with Lego bricks. Our technology correspondent, Mark Gislick, has more.
Lego needs no introduction, but for those unfamiliar with Fortnite, it's one of the biggest online games in the world, attracting more than 70 million players a month. It's perhaps most famous for its so-called Battle Royale mode. Up to 100 players have the chance to build virtual defences before they fight it out amongst each other. The last one standing wins. The title is free to play, but makes money by selling virtual items within the game, such as new outfits or weapons. Lego Fortnite is an entirely new game, which focuses more on building and exploration rather than combat. The new survival mode, as it's called, bears a marked resemblance to Minecraft, the world's biggest online game. The original Fortnite is no stranger to controversy, with questions being raised about child safety in the game since it launched in 2017. Adam Sussman, the boss of Epic Games, says that's been taken into consideration when designing the new version.
We've been on a journey. You don't implement these features in a week or a day. Like, these are things that we've been building for years and years. And so one of the things that we recently implemented was a rating system. So each piece of content is rated appropriately for the audience. And we allow, through our parental controls, the parents to decide what type of content their kids will be able to see.
The collaboration with Lego is a clear move to attract younger players to the Fortnite ecosystem. But given the criticism from some parents groups and even Prince Harry, there are those in the industry who think this represents a bit of a gamble for Epic Games. The new mode, featuring the world's most famous plastic bricks, will be added to Fortnite today. Will they manage to build an even bigger audience for this gaming behemoth?
Our technology correspondent, Mark Cheeslick. Here's a quick quiz question. What has Filipino hand loom weaving got in common with Maltese village fetes and Cuban rumba music? Well, the answer is that all of them have been adopted as intangible cultural heritage by the United Nations Culture Agency, UNESCO. There are nearly 700 cultural practices on that list, and now there's a new one. Yes, UNESCO has just announced that Italian opera is being added. I spoke about this to our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss.
This stems from a convention which was signed in 2003 to protect what is called intangible cultural heritage. Now, the idea is actually quite simple. If you want to preserve the physical object of a culture, like some handicraft or some other artwork, it's easy. You put it in a museum. But not so easy with a traditional form of dance, for example. Or here's another thing that's already on the list, traditional Kyrgyzstani midwifery. That is on the list. 145 countries signed up to this convention and basically agreed that if a traditional practice from their country is on the list, they will do everything they can to preserve and indeed promote it. And UNESCO say that's particularly important nowadays with globalization, the danger that culture becomes uniform. They want to preserve diversity, and this is the way they do it.
Paul, no disrespect meant to Kyrgyzstan's midwives, but why is Italian opera only now getting this recognition?
Well, I can tell you what UNESCO says. They say it's a physiologically controlled way of singing that enhances the carrying power of the voice and is associated with specific facial expressions. The knowledge and skills are transmitted orally between a maestro and a pupil. Now, of course, you could say other countries' offer traditions also have these qualities. The point is, though, that to be on the UNESCO list, it means you are the origin of this practice. I am reliably informed opera began in Florence in the 16th century. Interestingly, it was originally about setting Greek myths to music. So the origin's not exclusively Italian, but it's Italy that really took this tradition on. I should say Italy does already have entries on the UNESCO list, but these include the Italian way of mountain climbing. And also, I kid you not, also on the list is the specific Neapolitan way of preparing the dough for pizza. So Italian opera is in good company.
Our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.